very sad story to share with you guys. I got fired from my latest web development job. It's true. I just didn't know how to react. Hey, guys. It's Daniel Markham. I'm at DanielBMarkham.com, and we're here for the weekly Nerd Roundup. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup, well, golly dang, we're happy to have you this week. Nerd Roundup is when we get together with some friends every week or so and talk about what little articles I flag throughout the week and just shoot the shit and have fun. I think a team that can joke and have fun together can do about damn near anything together. I cannot teach you how to have fun and joke around, but I sure as shit can do it while you can watch. So I try to find people with the most diverse viewpoints I can find and just have fun every week. So here we are, Nerd Roundup. This week we have Greg Young. Greg, where are you at? You're here somewhere, Greg. I guess you'll join us in a little bit. James Green used to come by. He couldn't make it today. John Kern comes in and out. We also have Scott Amber, a bunch of other people that come by. But I know Greg's here somewhere, and so I'm just going to start going, and Greg can kind of pick up what he wants to. So the first link I had today was something I wrote last week. We used to talk about, you know, projects we've been working over the past week or so, and I actually wrote a very, very short list called Towards a New Online Ethics. And basically, about 15 years ago, I wrote an article about how evolutionary forces on social media was going to cause this total clusterfuck of people with conflicting interests and monetary interests. It was going to really create a mess. This is exactly what happened, my friends. And I've spent the last 15 years sort of figuring out, well, okay, now what are you going to do? Because that's what they asked me at the time, and it's a fair question. And I've decided what I am going to do. And after 15 years, I've come up with a small list of what I consider online ethics for me. And ethics are a set of rules that you decide amongst your professional group to keep your professional group in good standing. If there's not morals, they're not laws, I'm not telling you what you should or shouldn't do. For me alone, I have this list of 5 rules. And so if you're interested in that, you can find that on the blog. Greg, you back yet?
I am.
What have you been up to this past week?
Oh, just a bunch of code.
Okay.
What else are you going to do?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Could you tell me what you did? Because you said, oh, and then the only thing that dropped out was the thing you did. And then you said, what else are you going to do? So I really have no idea what we're talking about right now.
Oh, sorry. I think I ate a Dorito there, which might have caused a problem. I've actually been working on some very fun code now for a while. Dealing with SMS messages.
So we talked a little bit about this offline. I would like to suggest we table this to the end of the show. I'll stop recording. We can do like a 10 or 15 minute thing on it, and then we can come back and decide when we want to publish that part of it.
Yep.
Cool beans. So the first link we have is... Okay, so the first one I have this week is a tweet that says, it's time to say it, build less software. And dang if I didn't hit that record button again, but I'm not going to do that because I know now. But this is a... Are you there, Greg?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so this is all about... somebody saying, you know, dudes, we're not getting paid just to like become feature meals where we kick out hundreds and thousands of features. We're actually supposed to make some sort of value for other people. And by calling things epics or stories or features or whatever, that doesn't magically mean that they're actually useful pieces of stuff we're doing.
This actually is quite a complicated subject because I've sat on both sides of this fence. Where sometimes what I'm telling you to do, you might not understand the value of it. And I've also been the developer on the other side who is being told to do something, but I don't understand the value of it.
I had a team once that was doing a Java web app. And it was a total clusterfuck, and it turned to find out that they were just there to see if the organization could build Java web apps. That was the entire purpose. Nobody knew that.
I have literally built an entire system where the entire point of the system was to fail.
That's actually not a bad thing. I just think that, you know, we probably should do a better job of communicating. Because if the real features fail fast, then, you know, you want to know that. Hey, John, good to see you.
But then, can you imagine finding out later that the entire point of your system was to fail?
Yeah. You know, I know you've probably worked in places like this. There's a lot of dysfunctions. I've seen these things where, like, they'll ask a team for an estimate, and then they'll, like, double it, then somebody will lie about it, and they're all assuming that everybody's lying to one another.
But it was actually a highly functioning organization. The idea was, and I think I've mentioned this in the past, so we're going to have three teams build the same thing. We have three different ways of possibly doing this, and we expect this way with 70% certainty is going to be the right way. But we're still going to build the wrong way, because the wrong way might actually be more effective. We're just not sure yet.
I was on a team with the Immigration Service back in the 90s, and my boss asked me to set up a group of two or three people to build a feature out. And so I did that, and about a week later, I ran across another manager, and he, come to find out, he had a team of two or three people doing the same thing, and there were three of us. And she just sort of wandered through the floor finding managers and asking them to set little teams up because she didn't really trust the organization to do anything. So she figured she'd, like, ask everybody, eventually something good would happen. And that's exactly, it worked out fine for her, but it was a little frustrating.
Well, this is not at all a unreasonable strategy. There are numerous companies who literally do this deliberately.
Yeah, Apple did it, right? Yeah. Early on.
Yep, they did. They did, sure enough. Apple's like a whole other can of worms with Steve Jobs and sort of the egocentric, you know, visionary model thing he had going there. That was a wild ride for those folks. Probably not pleasant either.
Yeah, it's probably hard to copy.
Yeah, I get the feeling, and I'm out of my depth, but I get the feeling that Jobs kind of had this force of will idea that he could just take his force of will and then drive the organization. It worked for him, but it tends not to work with other people.
Yeah, and it's an intense drive, at once admirable and probably shocking to some people, because it doesn't play by the rules of the enterprise. But if you know, is there other ways that it could have been accomplished? Probably.
Well, this could actually be a very fun discussion if we were to define what the rules of the enterprise actually are.
Yeah, I'm kind of reminded of the movie Patton, and I'm reminded of Patton like every so often. And the reason why is not because Patton was some super genius, but because he had this image in his mind of what a general should look like in an army. And he acted the part as if he were on stage of being a general in the army. And because he did that, his army actually did things that, you know, they thought a general would ask him to do. So I get the feeling that you can actually sort of play the role of Chief Honcho and do it to such a good degree that it you can pull it off. But then, on the other hand, I think most of us probably are not that good at actor.
Yeah, it's interesting. But is it playing a role, or is it actually being the role? That's actually a good thought.
I don't think you're supposed to let. I think if they figure it out, you're not doing a good job of it.
Yeah, so that's just it. You know, are you actually just being it, or is it a role?
So there's
does it matter?
There's a line in the movie Patton where they were overwhelmed at the Battle of the Bulge. And Patton is telling his staff that they need to get together and pivot the army. And they're saying, hey, we're having all these problems. And he says, I want us to do blah, 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 or I don't want one single person to come back alive. And his chief of staff goes, sir, you have to be careful. The men aren't always sure when you're acting or not. And he said, they don't have to be sure. That's for me to know.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Do you guys know of Patton's vulgar speech?
No.
So I would have to, like, pull it up. I don't remember everything off the top of my head. But he apparently went up at one point and just started speaking in vulgarities to the troops. Like, the things he was telling them were things that should never, ever be said.
Says who?
Yeah, what was the old saying? Patton was a son of a bitch, but he was our son of a bitch.
Right.
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I just pulled it up. Here's his opening statement. Now, I want you to remember that no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country.
Yeah.
You won it by making the other poor bastard die for his country.
Right. Yeah, you need to watch the George C. Scott movie, Greg. And see, I think he starts the whole movie with that speech. Wonderful speech.
That sounds like a good one to watch. I haven't seen that in probably decades.
I think it's more interesting to me because I have some family members who were there with Pat in the Third Army, and none of them have a good opinion of him at all. Remember, one guy was shot. He was injured in a hospital. And Patton came in and he said, I want every swinging dick in this hospital that could walk, with take a gun and come out and fight. And he said, if I'd had a gun, he said, I'd shot that son of a bitch right there. So, you know, but he got the job done. So,
yeah. Yeah. Imagine General Washington had to deal with. Yes. You know, like his damn troops were barely fed and clothed. And cold.
And I don't think he was that good a general, to be honest with it. So, yeah, it was a bad thing all the way around.
Yeah, probably learning on the fly, for sure.
Learning on the fly.
God forbid we were discussed Francis Marion.
He had an image he wanted to project of being George Washington that didn't match. Lafayette said that Washington got really mad in one battle. He said, angels from heaven couldn't have come down and cursed better than Washington did at his soldiers that day when he got mad. Whoa.
Yeah, but at the same time, he certainly did a lot in those early, especially those early days.
Yeah, I think Washington's, and I don't want to denigrate him, but he stepped down. I mean, the thing he did that was so huge is he said, okay, I'm done now. You guys go run the country because I'm not.
Right. Mm-hmm. He set the precedent for two terms.
Yes.
Till freaking Roosevelt forced the issue. Dictator Roosevelt. Yeah.
It people tend to get quite enamored with their own abilities to do things. I don't think Roosevelt thought anybody else could do as good a job as he could.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like Woodrow Wilson. Yeah. Yeah, no one's...
To be fair, if Roosevelt were running another country today, the U.S. would probably bomb them.
Who knows? That's funny, though.
That went sort of a counterfactual question of the year, Greg. It's like, if Roosevelt was running another country, as I've done all this sort of... It's the modern times with FDR. I don't know. We would probably consider him quite a conservative leader, I think.
Yeah. Come on.
Well, he didn't believe in public sector unions. He had a lot of opinions that today we would consider conservative.
Yeah, and had one of the best propagandists, Bernays.
Oh, come on. He was a progressive conservative. That is literally what he called himself.
Yeah, I think, you know, FDR is one of the long tradition of kind of swollen-headed aristocrats, and I would even probably consider Washington as one of those. Probably the anti-pattern of that may have been maybe Lincoln or Reagan, but there have been a huge ton of people who just sort of deep in their heart felt like they were just better than everybody else.
What I have to kind of laugh at is how the definitions of words have changed over time.
That's how you win arguments.
Yes.
Fair play. But Can you imagine if we were to have someone run as a progressive conservative today?
It's funny because sometimes people ask me, they ask me whether or not the founding fathers were progressive or conservative. And the answer is yes. The only reasonable answer is yes. They stuck with some things that worked and didn't change them. And they changed a bunch of stuff that they thought if they didn't change, the country would self-destruct. So they were, the answer is yes, they did. They were both conservative and progressive.
Or pragmatic.
Yeah, pragmatic is probably a much better term. That describes them a lot better.
It is always kind of fun to think about, what if we were to take modern issues and take them back in time?
With whose mindset? Modern people's or the back in time people's?
Oh, no. So, like, if we were to take Thomas Jefferson and we were to ask him about many of the modern issues, what might his thoughts be on them?
Oh, my God. Jefferson's a great one for that because Jefferson is our only president who had a poet's heart. I mean, the guy, he was an intellectual kind of artist dude. He was probably one of the most artist poet dudes we had. So I don't know. That's a good one. I know he would not be happy with all the limits on speech we have. I know that.
Right. And I'm sure they'd be appalled at how they eviscerated states' rights.
Oh, I think Madison would have a lot to say about that one.
That's funny. Yeah. It's because the Anti-Federalists argued that we should not ratify the Constitution because if we did, that we'd end up with a standing army, we'd end up all... And they made all these arguments for exactly what happened. But at the time, the other side was like, oh, these guys are just a bunch of paranoid fools. We're never going to end up doing that stuff. And they were right on every count. Every count they were right on. It's just, it's weird.
It just took really long. Yeah.
Yeah. It just...
That's just it. I think I don't know. I know I've said this many times, and I don't know if it's true or if just wishful thinking, but sort of like the 17 folks who came together to create an Agile Manifesto was like a bizarre circumstance that ended up something pretty amazing. The 53 50 something folks that found themselves in Philadelphia, you know, like it's something you can't repeat. Yeah. It's just some strange, amazing thing that happened. They were open enough, left their egos at the door, hopefully, kind of like the manifesto. They had all manners of background, so to speak, from different perspectives. They brought in, you know, it's just cool to think about, hey, yeah, so if we want to refactor the government, you know, we want to get out from under this king bullshit, you know, do we want like a pure democracy? No. Do we want this? No. You know, I don't know. I find it, we're blessed to have had that accident of fortune that those folks put together the only way of governance that relied not on the fallibility of man, so to speak, right? It's not like some king grants you the authority to do this. No, it comes from above and nobody's above, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing where...
No. Some of it was from above. As an example, the Senate was originally appointed by state legislatures.
That's what I mean. Yeah. What I meant was...
There was a balance of coming from above and coming from below.
Yeah, but not above as in from your betters. Above as from another organization. Right? So the Senate was appointed by state legislatures because somebody had to be in charge of the structure of the federal government, and those people were best represented by the parties in the local states, not the voters themselves, which I think is a good call.
Yeah, that was the states' rights things that we eviscerated under like Wilson and stuff, along with the IRS came into be. But what I meant was...
And this is why I have your senators on TV pandering to the...
Exactly. Because now you can go bribe, you know, they're one of 100. So now you can go get into the pocket of a senator. They got way too much power. Anyway, what I meant by above was we get our rights from, and they, you know, they never use a specific religion,
but we get our rights from above is kind of what I meant. They can't be taken away. Right. They're inalienable. They're not, you know, all other forms of governments were always some, you know, some other way that you get power. And that's what I like in the fact that they followed it up with putting as much power at as low of level as possible to make it really, I think, you know, unfortunately, we bastardized it with stupid amendments, but that's, they also put that in there. So it is what it is.
I read a real good book on the Enlightenment, and the guy who wrote the book, his premise was the Enlightenment was all about the shift to having individuals use their own reasoning faculties to lead a happy life. That was what he considered Enlightenment to be. But given that prefix to the revolution, we had a bunch of people who were well-educated on the ways governments screw up, who also were unencumbered by previous systems. They could do whatever they wanted to do. And that was just sort of a magical time. I don't see that happening anywhere else, really.
Right. I don't think it did. You know, France screwed it up. You know, England isn't as free. Yeah.
And it wasn't because they were smart, because Jefferson, for instance, thought that France was going to do great because more power to the people, more whatever. And no, it just didn't work out that way. The compromises,
Jefferson's a bit more complex than that. Jefferson was also in France.
Yeah, he certainly was. He was our ambassador there, along with Franklin.
His words were extremely limited.
Jefferson was torn with the French thing, because he was there at the beginning. They went to him, as I recall, that, you know, he had a lot to do with the way they set up the initial delegation. He kept rooting for them to work it out, and it didn't. I think at one point he said he thought that France failed because they had so much debt owed from one group to the other that everybody in general was in favor of this beautiful, you know, sort of future in the sky, but nobody could actually wanted to give up their part of the debt that they were owed. And everybody wanted to keep, like, I still want to be a count, but I want to also have democracy. I still want to be, you know, and you just couldn't do that.
Yeah, interesting. Yep. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, and I wonder how, who knows the actual stats, but what I remember is, you know, a third of the people were for the revolution, a third were against, and a third were ambivalent. You know, so it's not like it takes necessarily a wild majority per se, but even that, you know, like you think about transformations and giant enterprises, and you know, is there a tipping point? Like, do you only need to get, you know, a handful of folks on board, and you know, the rest can be ambivalent. Some people can still be against it, clinging to, I want to be a count. I wonder if there's any analogies or parallels.
Well, I think there's a ton.
Can I give a direct quote from Thomas Jefferson?
Oh, please.
Please.
He's got great quotes.
The acquisition of Canada this year, as far as the neighborhood of Quebec, will be a mere matter of marching and will give us experience for the attack of Halifax and next, the final expulsion of England from the American continent.
Oui.
Go, Tommy J. Woohoo.
Yeah.
Like, can you even imagine if somebody today wrote that?
The funniest parts about Jefferson was he preaches all the state's powers, and he does the State of the Union, like, with a letter. He's very humble. And one of the first things he does is buy, like, the Louisiana Purchase. He takes on this power he has no right to, by the way. We're just going to buy all this stuff over here because we want to have it.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
it's kind of fascinating. I mean, like, there still is a plenty of land right now that the government owns that always bugs the crap out of me, especially, you know, like out west. It's ridiculous. You know, I want to say, you know, 80% of Utah is not owned by private people. It's like there's some crazy stats like that. It's all government property. And why that is, I don't know. But it's kind of crazy to think about back then. Hey, maybe we need to go into Canada. Like, what? You know, because it really wasn't Canada. You know, it was... You know, I don't think it was a separate country, right?
Well, they were all the rejection revolution that didn't want to be part of the United States. They all went north. That's how we ended up with Canada. The people who didn't want to be Americans.
Well, certainly, right above Vermont, we used to go skiing up there a lot in Mont Sutton, And I think they called it like the English colonies. And that's where a bunch of Tories, I guess, right? Is that what you call them? But yeah, they fled up there. So there's a funny, even though it's a French, you know, in theory, it's a French area, but they have all these funny English names of the towns. And it was because of that, from what I understood. Yeah.
I think where it gets really crazy is in the sort of Midwest, where you had the French traders and you had the English and you had the Spanish. I mean, there's like everybody involved over there. It's crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So this next article is from Scott Ambler. Large-scale cyrovolcanic resurfacing on Pluto. Turns out Pluto has a bunch of volcanoes on it. That's how it got all its topological features, and we never would have suspected that. It's a dang planet, okay?
Well, Guatemala has 32 volcanoes.
Wow. Guatemala is not a planet.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that this just goes to show that, you know, they were downplaying the importance of Pluto because of its size all this time. And then when they finally got a good look at it, they're going like, oh, wow, there's a whole bunch of really cool stuff here that we never would have suspected.
Yeah, I love the colorization.
Very cool stuff. Okay, so next article here is, where we got? Why you should start self-hosting. And this is just basically sort of a rant. The guy goes over Picasa, some other apps, and his point is that not only are internet providers out to farm your data, you actually end up with less stuff than you used to have. Because, I mean, Picasa was a much better app than Google Photos, but nope, you got Google Photos because they want to mine your data. So they're providers are actively looking to swap out things that do more useful things for you for things that do less useful things that you're going to have more sticky power to. And he's like, just host your own stuff. And I completely agree with his sentiment. I like reading a good rant every now and then.
Yeah, I remember the early days of computing and computers and stuff like that. You know, like the PC coming out, and there would be lots of little apps that I remember purchasing, like to defrag your disk and just other goofy little like peripheral add-ons. And then lo and behold, and Apple does this too, but Microsoft, you know, pretty soon that would become part of their system, you know, and then kind of wipe out the little guys. That always irritated me, even though it's a free market, but is it when those big guys, I don't actually think it is a free market with those big guys, because they often tilt the playing field in their favor in all kinds of ways. Like, yeah, Walmart's all cool with the raising the minimum wage. Yeah, we'll happily pay $15 an hour or more. Of course you will, because you can, and then you know it'll crush your competition.
Yes.
So of course you're for it, you know, but yeah, that sort of things, you know, that this article strikes me as something similar, where,
I completely agree with that. I think so often we fall to these sort of surface level bullshit that is put out. Oh yeah, sure, they're doing a good job because they're saving the whales or whatever the thing is they're doing to pitch to us, and we don't look at the other part of it. It's like, oh wait a minute here, come on. It's not really free email, okay? It's nothing in life is free. Google's not giving you free email. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I switched to DuckDuckGo, and yeah, you don't get all those creepy things that follow you around. Like, oh my God. Yeah.
I've scattered my stuff out. I've got Ubuntu on most of my systems for an OS. I've got Google for Gmail. I've got DuckDuckGo for searching. I'm trying to like spread things as far as I can instead of trying to stick with one provider.
You could go like Proton Mail or something, right? There are some, or what does, the Basecamp guys have hey.com, but that's a little more pricing.
Yeah, Google's got me locked because I've got 10 years of email now on my Google account. So, Jesus, it would be a pain to try to move that. So, this next article, one of the better tech nerdy type articles I've read in quite a while. It is Abstraction, Not What You Think It Is. if you're interested in the idea of abstracting in C++ or C# or Java or whatever, this is your article. It's from a professor who teaches computer science. He says, you know, we think of abstraction as being this one thing. Here's actually the different things it is. This is good from a, like, nerdy computer science viewpoint, but it's also kind of funny because humans use abstraction, the word abstraction, and they abstract all the time. And it doesn't necessarily match up with his definition here. Even though he's got a much better, clearer technical definition, it just doesn't matter. Because, you know, if you're in a room and somebody uses the word abstraction, it's not going to be what he's talking about. But it's good stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, I always use the important thing is to get the little thought bubbles above, you know, when someone says a word like that, if it's important for us to really understand each other, you need to work on defining what bubble appeared above each of our heads. Because, yeah, this is funny, his quotes. Especially the two that are complete opposites. It's hilarious. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's whether or not you're using the word abstraction, talking about, like, people talking to one another. Hey, that's an abstract idea. Or you're using the abstractions. I want to abstract out that interface or whatever. Then it's a different kind of thing, right?
Yeah, my good buddy and mine, John Turley, who you met in the UK, we had some funny conversation this morning about, you know, I don't know if you want to call it emergent phenomenon or, you know, abstract concepts, but things like a human, even, like, we're constantly changing. So, you know, even though you can touch us and think about a standing wave or a flame, like, you can't grab it, you can't touch it, you can't, you know, like, it exists, but does it, you know, like, yeah, in a really abstract concept. So that can, you know, that can make, that's good if we're drinking some beers or, you know, or smoking.
What's always fun is when you find something that breaks your abstraction.
Yeah.
Both in software engineering and general abstractions in the real world.
Or when you realize that all abstractions are bullshit. And once you finally realize that, it's like, holy shit, they were right in college all along.
Yeah, it's a shortcut to maybe hopefully try to convey something in less space.
Yes.
or not have to deal with the details. Who knows? Yeah. To me, the word interface from a software point of view is much simpler.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I learned that in Cruise Missile Engine. I remember doing some fuel control something or other. And here's a real interface. It's a plus or minus 5, you know, millivolt signal from the thermocouple or something for, you know, exhaust gas channel or flow meter or something, right? Like, you know, or true mechanical interfaces, pressure.
Well, but you used a word there, which is actually a really good example of an abstraction. A missile.
Yeah.
There are many, many different things a missile could be.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the cruise missile kind of is not even one of them, right? It's more like a funny looking flying cigar. It's not, whereas a missile, you think of more of like a, you know, fire and forget. But yeah, you're right. That is, yeah, even that. Yeah.
He uses the voltage analogy as a way of talking about abstractions. He talks about how voltages vary, and we boil that down to ones or zeros. He makes the point we were talking about last week, which is, you know, if you don't have to dig under the hood ever, then the abstraction works for you. It's okay. But if you're ever stuck digging under the hood, then it's no longer working for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the joke of the fighter pilot. Hey, how does that AIM 9X work? Works great. No freaking idea. I press a button and something happens. You know, yeah.
Press button, yeah. Bad guy, go boom.
Right. And all kinds of engineering, you know, is realized at the pointy end of that thing.
Next article, TikTok finally explains how the For You algorithm works. I don't know if you guys have followed along with TikTok over the years, but they have some sort of dark magic recommendation system they're using. And turns out they do this sort of, you post a video, they guess a small sort of test group. They show it to that test group, and then they continue to guess. And if their guesses keep getting better, then they keep showing your stuff to more and more people. And so it's this sort of, I guess, instantaneous test market they're doing. So it's, you know, kind of cool.
Is this at all surprising?
I am surprised. I am quite surprised.
Yeah, I've never downloaded it. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
To Greg's point, I'm not sure they actually told us something new or just sort of repeated what we already know, but I do think there's some difference in the guts here between this and what Facebook or Google or Twitter or other folks are doing.
This is literally what you would want to do if you were going to try to come into this as an optimization problem.
Well, here's the thing, and I agree with you, Greg, but this gets back to John's point about Walmart saying they raised minimum wage, right? It's like they're telling us what they're doing, but they're not really telling us what the hell they're doing. You get the impression that there's just one thing. You get the explain that you get the impression. You got a lung. Oh, my gosh. Goodness.
Mute, baby, mute.
Yeah.
Oh, mute. Sorry. Mute. I inhaled a potato chip.
Oh, my God. Okay, so this segment's brought to you by emphysema. Emphysema, the thing you don't want to have. You get the feeling that they're telling you. John, good. That they're telling you something, but then you read it and you're like, well, what the hell are they actually telling you?
Yeah, and why? Yeah.
Is this just a press release for TikTok, or are they actually doing something that?
I remember joking with some clients that, if you really want to screw up your competition, just open source your source code. That'll keep them busy for a while.
When I was interested in startups, I read all these books and went to these conferences on how to create your own business, find value. And I found that they were all very, very descriptive, and they all left out things that probably I should have known. So it was like they were helping me, but they were really kind of helping themselves more than they were me. Much more useful to them than it was me.
Yeah, know your customer.
So this next article is about NVIDIA, and they've got a artificial intelligence program that uses what they call neural reference imaging or neural re-illumination mapping or something that's takes a couple of three different pictures of somebody and creates a three-dimensional scene of that person. We talked about this with the old people last week. This is doing it real time, as I understand.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so you walk into like a conference or something, you take, six, seven pictures at different angles, you push the magic button, and then you take a video straight forward, and the computer actually does a 3D model of what's going on.
Wow, it's insane. To think that, when was I working there? The flight simulator, let's say late 80s, early 90s. $1 million, pretty crappy outside world rendering system. Even back then, NVIDIA, I think, was around, and the stuff you could get on a PC. So, yeah, this is impressive as hell, the things you can do.
Well, what's really interesting about it is when we start talking about where it's going to go. Mm. If I can do photorealistic images of me over the computer, and I can interact with you.
Yes.
Well, what else can happen?
You can develop force gloves that touch.
Well, not only that, but how do I know? I can't tell you right now, what's going on in Ukraine. I have to review, a dozen different sources with COVID. You end up having to be, a PhD on research to figure out what's happening in the world. Imagine a world in which everything you consume is generated by stuff like this.
Well, you already should be leery of trusting videos. Stuff that they can produce, is ridiculous, and ways that you can edit videos make it a lot harder to tell if it was doctored or real or not.
So we had this thing with, and I'm going to bring up a political thing, but it's interesting. Hunter Biden had some email thing. There was an issue with the president's son and his laptop. As always, these things come up the last few weeks before the election, and they're always, this is bullshit. You waited and dropped it and blah, blah, blah. But this is another good example of is it something that's completely fake? Is it something that's not? And as I understand it, several major social media providers refuse to let people even talk about this thing.
Yep.
And now it turns out it was a thing. So, wow, thanks for protecting us from something that you thought wasn't true. That's a weird dystopian place we've ended up in.
Yep. Because too few people are in charge of too few outlets.
Yes. And I say that as somebody who has no attraction to either one of the presidential candidates and pox upon all their houses, and I wish they'd burn in hell forever, but... I mean, it's still an interesting thing about social media deciding you can know this, you can't know that. That's not what they wanted to be. When I signed up for Facebook, there was no screen that says, oh, by the way, once you sign up, we'll be telling you what's okay to talk about or not. It's like, no, they didn't say that. Nope, this is bait and switch. You're telling me you're giving me something to share pictures about my kid, and what you're delivering is something where you control the information flow across the world. That's not, it's bullshit.
Yeah, and they actually... Zuckerberg put out, I forget, 500 million? Some ridiculous amount of money to actually put influence ads in the Facebook for one candidate. Yeah, that's like, I thought it used to be just a really one of the world's shittiest interfaces that somehow people use. And then it turned into this big political arm. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm going to go back a bit here. And excuse me for going back a bit.
To Jefferson and pamphlets?
No. I'm going to go back to 2011.
Ooh. Okay. Do tell. I know what I was doing that year.
There was an article by CBS News, which is social media is a tool of the CIA. Seriously.
Yeah.
There you go.
But today, if we talk to CBS, it'll be like, oh, no, it's all completely fine. It's not really anything going on.
It's a weird thing. There's usually a scene in a movie, like, I don't know, maybe, what was that one Robin Williams did where he was the teacher? There's all these scenes that they do with a classroom, and they ask the kids, you know, what's okay to say or not say, and one of the smart kids stands up, says, oh, this is okay to say, and then somebody says, no, this is okay. And then the teacher quickly demonstrates that we are unable to determine what's okay. Or so. Yeah, and the kids are like, oh, wow, thank you, teacher. You've helped us out. It's just like the real, we're LARPing this whole damn scene, like with people who have billions of dollars right now. It's bizarre.
By the way, if people want a reference to the article that I was mentioning, It is by Jim Edwards and was published on July 11th. 2011.
Hey, if you want to pop a link in the text part of the room, that'd be cool.
Will do.
There's some cool technology that, like Matterport, Matterport, that they've got little gizmos, like for pre-planning buildings or, you know, just showing a rental property or something. Like I see the tripods in that video, you know, the camera set up. Well, here you can put a, you know, a camera and it's GPS. So you put a camera in the building and then you move it. And then you can, it builds a 3D model. And you can actually go from point to point and look around. And, you know, so it does a really cool scan. And even that, you know, like for the price, for what you can get, for the ability to document what's in the building and where things are. To be able to marry it to other apps, and you know, like it is pretty astounding how the video, you know, far be it for me to figure out is the M1 chip, you know, is the rate of growth of the chips faster or is it the video? But for me, the just the video realism that has gone in the time that I've been playing games on computers and using stuff like what I just mentioned for Matterport, it's impressive as hell.
It is, and we've got like this double-edged sword where like part of it's really cool, part of it's like really scary. There was a Hacker News comment that came up after this 3D thing with NVIDIA, and this guy actually worked on development, which he worked in a culture that had ancestor worship, and what he did was he ended up making an app that brought your ancestors back so you could interact with them, like we were talking last week.
Yeah.
But the kicker was, this is actually a surveillance app being put together and funded by the government because they feel like you'll tell grandpa whether or not you like the government or not. It's scary as hell.
Yeah, that's why, you know, the I always love the Phil Donahue and Milton Friedman, you know, debate type thing where, you know, Phil, of course, is pushing for big government. And Milton Friedman's like, well, the day that something like this is how I always remember it's is like the day that angels are running the government, you know, I might trust them. But until then, yeah, smaller is better. And yeah, because they're people too. Like, do you think people are somehow better because they're not in big evil corporate? They're like, what, only altruist people go to the government? Yeah, you got to be kidding me. So, yeah. And it's this weird thing that there's trust.
I'm sorry, sir, but the Honorable Ray Nagin would strongly disagree with you.
Ray Nagin?
Yes, the old mayor of New Orleans.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, get those buses going. It wasn't me. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
I think the interesting thing here isn't, and we're doing hitting the political angle of this, but what's happening is as people are developing applications that are becoming popular, they're forced with the decisions that used to be made by governments. Like what's okay to say with a million people at a time? What's okay? What kind of commercials can we run on this platform that's going to go around the world? You know, what speech should we allow? And it's, there are no right answers to these questions. It's one of the reasons we have amendments that prevent, you know, speech from being controlled is because you can't make a right answer. It doesn't exist.
Well, no, but it's horrifically more complicated than this because then you also then have them being regulated by the government.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Because if you don't have the right policy, for instance, you may not have a company anymore in China.
Yeah. You might also be sued. You might also be... So you literally have these private companies which are acting as puppets.
Or puppeteers.
Or puppeteers. And this is due to, bada boom, bada bing, abstractions. Because they have to extract out the customers in order to sell to customers. And once they start doing generalizations or abstractions of people, well, then they're in the policy, politics, procedure, legislation world and not the, hey, I want to make something for one person kind of thing. I mean, let's face it, really what Facebook is doing, they don't care about all of this, what makes governments work stuff. They just want to make a bunch of money. And to make a bunch of money, they're just trying to find the little way through all of this stuff with all these different governments and all these different licensing requirements so they can continue to make all the money they can. This is the long and short of both Hollywood and social media.
Well, but it becomes a bit more complex in that... They are very often even directly paid by the government.
They are paid by the government, yeah. And then there are governments that are setting up like thousands and thousands of anonymous and fake accounts to sort of sway the algorithms here or there. It's insane.
Yeah, it's a hopefully a long, slow, not too painful learning, you know, by society. Well, time will tell.
Yeah, I think if I were a government, I don't keep hitting this nail on the head, but it's important. If I were a government, what I would do, I would find some insiders at the social media companies. I would have them give me the information they use to sort without publishing it. And then I would create fake accounts to manipulate the algorithms. And then I can get whatever I want put on social media. And the companies themselves are not smart enough to figure out whether they're being used or not. And it's a perfect world almost.
I think you spoke a bit incorrectly there and that the companies are not.
Not what?
Companies are not.
Honestly,
what?
The companies don't care.
Right. Right. Yeah. My point being that the whole purpose of machine learning AI algorithms is that the machine reasons faster than we can. So a lot of times you ask them, these social media companies, like, why do you do that? And they say, because algorithms. And there's just no, you can't get beyond that answer. There's no more detail there. So this is really good lead into this next two articles, which is about COVID-19. I think maybe it's time to begin talking about that. How we got herd immunity wrong and the tragic folly of lockdown. And so long story short, COVID-19 has been a smorgasbord of bullshit statistics back and forth and politics getting involved in science and vice versa. Organizations have found that organization messaging is more important than actually the mission of the organization. It's been a mess on several levels on all sides. But we are able to go back and do total deaths per country. You can take a country, you can look at the deaths over the years, you can take the COVID epidemic and see if the deaths have changed, and you can see, given this one variable, whether or not the deaths have increased or not. And they're finding some interesting information that we're going to have a hard time digesting, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a weird, really, really weird self-created dilemma where there's a lot of folks who are clinging to a belief such that when things come up, you know, like I triple back and boosted and I still get, you know, get COVID or something like that. There's a lot of making sure that my world isn't rocked, right? Yeah, there's like it's a crazy phenomenon what happened to this whole thing, you know.
What became weird. I thought I was perfectly happy with politicians making bad choices because we had incomplete data and I knew this was going to happen. And I was also happy being safe, be extra safe. I mean, God knows. Yeah. But what happened was they got locked in these political positions and then they didn't want to give up the political position because politics. And they didn't want their organization or their party or whatever looking bad. And so now I'm watching epidemiologists plead with other epidemiologists to like release some of the lockdowns because they don't make any mathematical sense. It's like, this is just a political discussion. They're just using math to beat one another up with.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. And it's, someone's going to have fascinating time researching this 20 years from now and how screwed up most countries' reactions were, not everyone.
I think the funny thing, when I started studying this, I guess year before last, one of the guys who's the scientist at the time, this is before it became popular, said, look at the body bags. Look at the body bags and who they're burying. He said, because every place we've been that's had a pandemic, the government immediately starts lying to itself and to other people. We can't get good data, but you got to bury people that are dead. So the data we go for is the body bags and the funeral poems and all that stuff, because it becomes very hard to hide that stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think they were even had crazy footage from, you know, China where there was a ton of going on, you know. But yeah, I felt, again, I did far too much research and got way too into it, mostly because I was trying to protect the kids here in our school. And I was so like, all right, to your point in the beginning, okay, Trump, okay, whoever, you just got told by these people who do this modeling that, you know, 4 million people are going to die, you know, some insane amount are going to die. Sure. Not going to die in like 2 years or 3 years, right? Not like, what, going to die this year. Okay, up then, and let's sort this out. Let's figure it out. Greg, do you have a bunch of like machines running in the background? I hear some funny printer noises. But yeah, the point was that, you know, 2 weeks to slow the spread, you know, like some people would still want to be slow in that spread, you know, or flatten the curve, whatever the hell. And for me, it was getting into it and researching it from all kinds of angles. So much bad things going on. And I love the people who go, well, yeah, the day that you're a medical guy, John, like, no, I'm a fucking sentient human being that knows how to do critical analysis and I can read too.
Yeah.
Frankly, most of the doctors, they're too damn busy doing their job to worry about other crap. So, not, you know, so stop it with the ad hominem attacks.
I actually do research and you're not doing, okay, fuck you. I can do research. I'm not a fucking moron. Right? I mean, that did get a little old pretty quickly. I tell you what I kept running into And this is just sort of a personality difference. We would run into the stuff where the science would go so far and there would be conflicting information. And one bunch would say, you know, okay, we don't really know the danger here. It's conflicting information. Usually it works out on this side, so let's make this call. And the other bunch would go, okay, we don't know the information here. We don't know how it's going to work out. If it goes the other way, bad things will happen. So let's make this other call. And so it became this precautionary principle, like back and forth of like, well, as long as I can imagine some bad thing that might happen, I got the trump card. What are you going to play now, bub? And it's like, yeah, okay, but you can't keep running that game because that's not always good. That's a stupid game to play long term.
Yeah, but the psychological impact to a lot of people, that's even as we were easing restrictions, you know, like I fought tooth and nail to try to make sure and help provide a lot of data and information to our fellow board members and to the public. You know, I'm kind of known as the dopey, you know, power, you know, I make presentations to try to break down what are we trying to do, because I still think it's a crime what was done to our children and lockdowns and send them home. You forget about the whole, since, you know, March 2020, the last part of that year, worthless. Right? Nobody got anything out of that.
I agree.
And just the crime of keeping kids masked and, you know,
what worries me is much more the having gotten away with the crime and the new crimes that will come.
Yes. I will be happy if we're not wearing masks from here on out.
Yeah, newsflash. It's the aerosol. Yeah. You know, like, okay, it might stop 10%, 12%, and then people can go, well, that's better than nothing. Fine, go ahead and wear it, but our immune system is also better than nothing. And treat that as part of this, you know, this is a game that's going on for millions of years, you know, virus, human, virus, human, virus, human. And we screwed it up. The last thing you want to do, this is from an epidemiologist that made a lot of sense, is vaccinate during a freaking pandemic. If you want to F up, especially the kind of vaccine we had, which targeted the single, you know, spike protein, and actually the little biting, the little thing at the top, how it latches on, it targeted that specific of brewing with Mother Nature and how we, you know, like, do it for the folks who need the most protection, but blanketing and especially doing it with kids, that's actually how you build the immunity. That's how it's gone on for eons. You know, like the kids will get it, you know, bring the cold home from school, right? You build those immunities up over life. And we just interjected with a ton of ego.
Yeah.
And maybe, let's say, a ton of money. That I'm sure the pharmaceutical, but yeah, you know, you interjected and broke the normal way that we fend off and live through these sorts of things. I think the tragedy is we screwed up the ability to actually build the good immunities. So there's a lot of people that actually aren't protected, but think they are and are only partly protected. And we didn't get that broad spectrum that a normal vaccine, and calling it a vaccine is bogus. You know, we're so used to vaccine meaning sterilized, like you take it and it's good for 20 years or more, right? And this is, hey, it's good for about, I don't know, a couple months, and take some more.
The much more interesting numbers that have come out, and I don't know if either of you guys have followed up on this, are how many people have actually had COVID.
Yeah, what about that?
Where it's like when they actually go and do tests, it's like, well, we found out that 70% of the population has actually had it.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of issues here. One of them I want to point out because I want to. By the way, John, I'm with you in heart because I could rant for a long time on this. I have been holding my tongue for a while. Having said that, there are a lot of things we don't know, and like I said earlier, people take the idea that we don't know stuff, and they apply the precautionary principle, and then they just go batshit on, let's prevent, you know, any bad thing at all. It's the old story about the one-eyed mule. He would go off the bridge on the side of his good eye because he was so afraid of his bad eye, he just would fall off on the other side. we don't know what viruses really do long term. Just regular viruses, like cold viruses. A lot of this shit, we just don't know. We've never really studied. So we're finding stuff about COVID that's true of all viruses, perhaps, or all viruses, or at least coronaviruses, that we just didn't know anything about before. What bothers me is that the politicians, their frickin' job is to take a bunch of contradictory data that's incomplete, that doesn't make sense, that not everybody's going to be happy with, and make a frickin' decision. And change and learn and do that, keep going and doing that. But what they did was they circled the wagons in two little groups of wagons, and then they said, look at the science. It's like, bullshit, you guys are not doing your job, man. This is the one job you have to do, and you're not doing it.
I believe you're missing what their actual job is. They are paid far more by people outside of what they're dealing with than they are with their salary.
Yes.
Which is bad.
Yeah. That's a tangential point, but you're correct. The job, as I understand it, I'm electing you for, is different than the job, as Greg is describing, that you're actually making your money from. So this next one is a man arrested for attaching a watch to his girlfriend's car. Weird story. He's a stalker, and he used the Apple tracking thing to track his girlfriend. He's a dangerous guy, should go to jail, but I'm just not sure, like, attaching a watch to the wheel of your girlfriend's car should be some sort of crime. I'm not sure. Like, he's a bad guy.
Well, no, it should be a crime, because there's a better place to put it than on the wheel.
He'd probably be scoring up on that Fitbit stuff, you ask me. That's probably the real story here. That's what he should go to jail for.
Exactly. It's like, how many steps did I have today?
So my wife has this new Fitbit, and, like, she'll be working at the computer, and she'll just stand up and start marching in place. I'm like, what are you doing? And she's like, well, the Fitbit tells me I have to exercise. I'm like, what the hell? We got this thing backwards.
Yeah. Well, you can tell her that yesterday I had 43,300 steps, and I'm not walking at the moment, but I've got 29,700. So,
wow.
Get a walking treadmill.
Yeah, I bought it.
I have actually learned a very, very good exercise program. It is based entirely around helping people you know move.
Helping people move.
If you go there and you're going to move, you know, a bunch of couches, some dressers, you'd be amazed how many calories you burn per day.
Yeah. I thought you meant just, like, Melissa, to get up and move. I thought you meant just move. Like, move. Not actually lifting furniture. Yeah.
Yeah, my son was moving this past week, and I went to his apartment and said, you guys, I'm here to consult. I kind of, like, provide advice. I'll tell jokes, but... Homeboy here, 57, and I'll help lift the couch and, like, be sore for 2 weeks. I'm not going to do that.
Right. Yeah.
This next article Greg was talking about, he liked a lot. This is Lessons on Burnout. By the way, Diego, can you hear me better now? We'll see. He was
Yes, we can, by the way. We can hear you better.
All right, cool beans. So this is a really, really cool article, which is talking about how the team should be enjoying themselves. And once they enjoy themselves, they're actually going to do a lot better work. This is kind of what we talk about on Nerd Roundup every week. This is, like, work smart, not like a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. A happy team is a good team.
Yeah, I think this has a lot of actual really good content in it. Not only the trebuchet allegory, but then the very, you know, I don't know if it's acting, but the very disturbing video of the shape sorter that's kind of freaking out the woman watching the person do it wrong. And then all the way to,
You know,
some of the folks that we're consulting with right now, you know, there's some big problems out there. A bunch of remote, you know, teams being remote, you know, some hopefully coming back. But yeah, I think there's a lot of repercussions for what happened in the past 2 years. And it's It's no shit. I mean, there is a lot of damage.
So I want to skip over this next one, which actually Diego sent in, because you're talking about the...
Sorry, Dan, can I just respond really quickly?
Sure, the next two articles are related, but sure.
There has been a lot of damage that's been done. But a better way of thinking about it is, what are the opportunities today?
Maybe so, but I've got two more articles on how things are still fucked up, so I want to talk about that.
Okay, no worries.
Hey, I don't have articles on it. Now, but to John's point, we did COVID, we did the lockdown from COVID, overreaction, the political part of this, and now we're kind of segueing into, well, gee, we're really doing a bad job at our work because of COVID and a lot of other reasons. And one article here is, worst part of working from home is now haunting reopened offices. So companies are just mandating that you have to go back to work, like, you know, 1, 2, 3 days a week. And all the team is coming back different days. So you're just going to the office sitting by yourself at a little desk and still doing the Zoom meetings and all the shit you'd be doing from home. It's like double dumbass. Gee.
Well, you keep expecting these things to make sense. If there's one thing that we've learned over the last couple of years, is that they almost never make sense.
I spend most of my life as a consultant with that sort of puzzled dog look, like,
yeah,
this makes sense to you, does it? Yes. Could you explain some more about why this makes, really? So yeah, there's this other article. I hate to say this, but this guy wins the worst technical article of the year award so far for me. He's like, well, why don't they just build cars in sprints? Because, dang it, manufacturing isn't a sprint. And he's right. There's a difference between manufacturing and creative work, but he's conflating it all together, and that makes him quite confused. And it's a wondrous, wonderful read on how, if you don't know what the fuck you're talking about, you're never going to end up anywhere useful, but you will have fun kind of wandering around. And he does this. For a great counterpoint, please go to the Discord room and the programming series. I posted a video, came out yesterday. It's about how Elon Musk builds Teslas. And my friends, he builds Teslas using mobbing, agile XP programming practices. Wonderful video. And this makes a great counterpoint to this guy's essay.
What could possibly go wrong with having a 3-year plan for how to build our next car?
I could do an hour just on that video. It was excellent. One of the things the guy says, he's like, you know, when we're building hardware, if you think of it like building software, the part about putting hardware together is the compiler. And so what we're trying to do is to try to shorten that compilation process down as quickly as possible. He said, once we get that under 30 days, he said, for some reason, people start thinking differently about the way they're building stuff. Once we get under a day, and he said, as we tighten up that compilation cycle between idea and piece of hardware, you get more and more into that sort of experimental hypothesis-driven development stuff. All the good stuff happens once you sort of shorten that cycle.
Yeah, that's so true in so many things that we deal with as software people is, yeah, if you could make this part easier, what might that unleash? Yeah, I don't know, because it takes us forever to get stuff out the door, and we'll never know. Yeah, that's right. You'll never know.
And yeah, the guy with the why don't we do manufacturing in sprints? He's like, well, you know, some features just take longer than 2 weeks to put together. I'm like, oh God, not that fucking canard again. I mean, come on, gee. I mean, the 50th time you've read this, would not it occur to you they're like, go looking on the internet somewhere else for somebody who doesn't have that problem and read how they solved it? Would this not never occur to you?
Yeah. No.
Who could imagine that anyone has ever dealt with such problems?
Yeah.
Yeah, you think? It must just be unique to me, because we have a unique business, don't you know? Yeah, that's my favorite. Yeah, a group that we just started working with, I just dropped in to, you know, observe one of the daily things, and somebody said, hey, you know, like the folks are complaining about getting stuff done in the 2-week sprint that we've started. And can we extend that to 3 weeks? And you know what I said, like, without skipping a beat. No. Matter of fact, just the fact that you asked that, I'm going to ask you to do it in 1 week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I didn't, but I said that just in kind of in jest. But
I used to tell them I'd be doing day sprints, and I was kind of half joking. Right. Because...
Yeah, exactly. And another guy that I work with, he says, yeah, you know, I forced from team down to 2 day sprints. They were like getting, you know, no, like that's just, and just like maybe this person in the sprint in the car thing, you know, it's like, you know, somebody even higher up in that company mentioned something about, well, yeah, we, you know, we want to slow down. Well, that ain't how you slow down. No, you slow, you know, like, we're not talking about expanding time. You know, as a way to, no, we're talking about slow down what you might have put in there, like the flow, slow your flow rate down, but don't, you know, anyway, I think there's just a lot of unclear concepts of.
One thing that's often not discussed, which is a very, very important thing here, is not even necessarily the speed that we're working at. It's the predictability that we're working at.
Absolutely. That's what they want, predictability. Yep. And to do that, don't make it bigger. Yeah.
One of the guys, one of the points the guy makes in the article about the Musk companies is that they're doing all this Agile XP stuff, but they don't use any of the names. They don't use like mobbing or any of that stuff. He says like they do it all. They've organically grown into doing it, but nobody uses those terms. And he said everybody's doing a little tiny little, but it amazes me that once we put a label on something, it's almost like we immediately misinterpret what the label means and we go misapply it and we, mm-hmm. you know, it becomes a clusterfuck. It's because, wait a minute, the label represents from adaptive process to do really well. If you're not doing really well in an adaptive fashion, you probably don't know what the label means.
Well, to be fair, if there is a certificate for an adaptive process manager.
Yeah. There isn't.
No.
Yeah. It's the mindset, so to speak. It's being able to grok what's really going on and not just follow some label.
I think it's easy to sort of talk about and label, talk about and manage things that are easy to label, talk about and manage, and ignore things that are difficult. And the real work isn't something that you can actually see. It's happening inside people's heads most of the time. So it's not a thing like a guy working at a French fry station. You walk up, oh, hey, Joe, you're cooking too many French fries. It doesn't work the way we train managers to say it's going to work.
Well, I think a big part of it is also the fallback. So if I am a Scrum certified master and I did things as they were prescribed, then I can say, well, I did them as they were prescribed, regardless of if it made any amount of, and excuse my language here, fucking sense.
Yep. Nope, you're right. There's a lot of people who are actually inhibiting progress at their own company because they're doing things just like that, Greg. They're doing the thing they're supposed to be doing. I'd argue that 90% of the people in bad companies should just stay home, and the company would do better just for them. They keep paying them. They would do better for these people not to be participating in the value creation. It's a crazy, crazy world we've created.
One company I was working with, they had these business priorities, and if you fell below the line, right, your stuff didn't get you know, love. There was one gal that we were talking with that stuff fell below the line, and I'm like, so do you just go home? Like, what do you do if, like, all right, yeah, or not, well, now we just keep working, doing some, I'm like, okay, seems bizarre, like, you know, that's just too much stuff in flight. There's just all kinds of stuff all over the factory floor. If only they had one, that they'd, you know, be tripping over it. Maybe they could recognize it. But yeah, it's like, wow. So, you know, and I tried to use an analogy. What if you had 10 product request generators and only one developer? How do you think that's going to go? You know, poorly? And yeah, I don't know, strange. Why is this so difficult for so many people?
What was the old saying? I recently had an interview with a company who wanted me to come on at CTO or near CTO level. And one of the things they were asking me is, how would you focus everything? And my answer was, I would go sit with every team. And talk to them. And figure out what their impediments were. And they looked at me like I was nuts. What they wanted was an answer of how I'm going to basically take three levels of feedback. So, like, the first layer goes through the second layer, which goes through the third layer. Now it comes to me. And then just take that and somehow act upon it.
Dude, they wanted a defect taxonomy, man. You have to, you're going to have to come up with them defect taxonomies if you're going to. And you, maybe some other big words in there as well. They wanted you to, like, play, you know, Data Man, Mr. Spock.
Yeah, I don't know. My go-to is, like, what's the business? What the hell are you trying to do? What's, you know, anchor your damn world around what it is that you're doing to make money, and then make some tough decisions around
how to
prioritize.
The right way to manage a development team is not to sit three levels above them with middle managers in the middle. The right way to deal with a development team is to take them out for beers on a Thursday and ask them, so what the hell is going on? Show me some code.
From that perspective, yeah.
The guy was talking about the Musk companies. He said sometimes Elon talks about how he's just sick of working there. And he said what he really means is that Musk, the guy, the billionaire dude, welds. He welds, he does math, he does programming. He sees where the bottlenecks are, and he goes in and mobs with the people on the bottlenecks. He works on the floor with everybody else in those teams because he not only needs to help them move through the bottleneck, he needs to be aware of the larger system that created the bottleneck to begin with. And he also probably needs to train people on how to get rid of these bottlenecks and automate and all that. So he's actually sort of working in the worst team every day. That's just his job. Go to the worst spot and work. And that, I guess that would kind of get old after a while.
But to be honest, working on the worst team every day is actually a wonderful job.
Nowhere to go but up.
Nowhere to go but up. It's all improvement.
Yeah.
Well, but it's you're put on this horrific team. You have easy gains to make. Coming into a highly functioning team and giving gains to them is actually difficult.
But yeah, there's a thing that happens here when you work on these bottleneck teams, and you start to learn where you're wrong about how you think the company works. That's actually when you actually start. This is your freaking job as a manager, is to learn. But this actually happens when you start doing this bottleneck work, because then you're like, oh my God, this assumption we made is not true. This thing these guys were telling me was a generalization. This doesn't apply here. And those become sort of burdens you have to carry once you leave that team to the rest of the org.
So do you guys know about the Amazon warehouse?
Yeah, there's some that I drive by frequently.
Well, no, but they...
Can you be more specific, Grant?
Done a lot of very interesting optimizations around these things.
Okay. Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah, I would automate the shit out of it.
Yeah.
And then use the humans for the hard stuff.
Well, no, the humans are still mostly used for going and taking a box from this shelf and moving it to the front. But they've done a lot of optimizations more socially, if that makes sense. So as an example, if you were to come here, there's a bus that will pick people up and drop them off afterwards.
Yeah, they did that a lot in India for, you know, dev centers, campuses.
So guys, we're running over, so I want to be respectful. Let me say goodbye, but what have you been, you guys been watching any good TV shows or movies or books this past week?
Did I tell you that I watched Interstellar?
Oh, yes.
I forget.
Very cool, yeah. We talked about the ray tracing thing last week.
And I don't know if I was here last week. I forget. And then I watched The Big Short. Just as a reminder about what a shit show that whole subprime mortgage thing was. Yeah, that's about it.
I finished up watching the last two seasons of Westworld on HBO Max while I was doing other stuff and realized that I was right to bail out after the first season because it was just a hot mess. But it was, I guess I accomplished watching the last two seasons. I've watched Westworld. That was my big deal. How about you, Greg? Any books or anything?
Well, I've got one I'm meaning to get into. Halo.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. We watched the first episode of that with my son, and I think I'm going to spend more time watching the TV show than the dang game. It looked, it's a lot of stuff blowing up on it. That's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah? Halo? Is that what you're talking about?
Yep.
Is that a series?
Yeah, Amazon did it as a series.
But I think there's only like one or two episodes out now.
Oh, okay.
Yes. If you like things blowing up, I can't recommend it enough. A lot of things blowing up. Very, very important.
What can possibly go wrong with things blowing up?
Oh, I also watched The Hateful Eight. Speaking of a lot of things blowing up.
What was that about?
It's pretty wild. Like, you probably might get into it. It's like a crazy movie from Quentin Tarantino. That's got, you know, some of his goofy, you know, sometimes changing the timeline and showing you something and then back again. So it's a lot of blood and guts, but sort of a fascinating, I said it was kind of like Clue, like whodunit.
With gun,
yeah. So there's
with gun, like Clue with explosives.
Yeah, Clue with a lot of people who are doing it. Yeah, and just a kind of a fascinating story of folks getting trapped in a, you know, they're on a wagon trail, late 1800s, you know, wild western, Montana or Wyoming, I think Wyoming. Snowstorms coming, and so the stagecoach, they all have to stay in, you know, in this rest stop area that's, you know, kind of got bunk beds and restaurant and barn, so they gotta wait out the storm.
Although I have a good one in my mind that people who are listening to it should watch, and I'm going to watch Casino.
That was a mob movie, right? 80s, 90s?
Yeah, Casino was an old mob movie. It was from mid-90s, I believe. It was kind of a fun movie as well.
Yeah, Joe Pesci, I think, was in it.
Oh, like the cast of it is impeccable.
By the way, if you like The Sopranos, HBO Max also has this... 2-hour movie, like a prequel to The Sopranos. I've been meaning to watch that.
If I remember correctly as well, it's produced by Scorsese.
Ooh, cool. Very cool. Okay, so let me do my goodbye thing. Hang on, guys. Well, there you go, guys. You've wasted yet another hour and 20 minutes or so on Nerd Roundup. We're happy to have you this week. Had a lot of fun. We're here every week. DanielBMarkham.com. I will see you on the internet. Cool, guys. I'm sorry you ran over, John. I hope that wasn't a problem for your scheduling. I'm sorry you ran over, John. I hope that's not a problem for your schedule or anything.
No. I got a little reprieve, a little less hectic. I just had a meeting right before this one. But let me just ask a goofy question. Did you screen share during this, or was it just for video? Like, I'm wondering, did I get in this room wrong? And because all I see is funny videos, and I don't see a screen share.
Yeah, you should be good. You should be seeing a picture of yourself and me, right?
Yeah, and yeah, I didn't see any. I didn't see you sharing any articles or anything.
Behind me, do you see like scientists translate a spiderweb into music?
No, and I figured you probably were. It didn't matter because I was following.
You're not sharing your screen.
But, okay. Now that's weird, guys. What I'm seeing is not what you're seeing. That's so. Do you see the duck? Do you see a duck?
No.
No, all I literally have is four panels with our faces, except only your face and my face, and the rest are default.
Ah, okay.
So I didn't know if I just got in here funny, and I didn't want to say anything, but normally you have that sort of blended, you know, you're in front of something, and you're kind of floating, and I didn't see that, so.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, I don't, well, that's weird.
Check your DMs.